For thousands of years, civilization has been a destructive force, both ecologically and culturally. Deep in the abyss of the sixth extinction, the future of humanity and our other-than-human kin hangs by a thread. At this pivotal moment in time, we must reach back into the depths of the human story and uncover our mistakes. I invite you to go with me down the rabbit hole as I seek out the silenced, forgotten, buried, abandoned, and demonized stories and practices of regenerative, egalitarian, place-based cultures. There is still time to reconnect with what we have lost, to restore our broken relationships to the land where we dwell, and to remember the human place in the wild. Hello, and welcome to the Rewilding Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Michael Bauer. I'm coming to you from Portland, Oregon, the traditional territory of the Multnomah and Clackamas Chinookan people, as well as the Kalapuya, Malala, Cowlitz, and many other tribal groups who have lived here, subsisted here, and traveled here to trade and make their living since time immemorial. This podcast is produced in partnership with Rewild Portland, a nonprofit organization, and is made possible through financial support from our listeners. The best way to keep the podcast going is to become a recurring monthly supporter. If you feel inspired to contribute, you can make a donation by following the link in the podcast notes. You can also help by sharing our podcast on social media and writing us a review on iTunes. Today on the podcast, I'm excited to share with you all my friend Bartle, someone who's been an inspiration and role model to me. One of the reasons I look up to Bartle is her innate sense of humility, authenticity, and sheer confidence. It's not the kind of arrogant confidence of feeling you are superior or better than others, feigning bravado to convince the world and yourself that you are worthy. It's the kind of confidence that simply says, if I put my mind to something, if I stay as true and authentic to myself as possible, I can accomplish it. And I'm not concerned with convincing people of my authenticity or confidence through performance, but through practice. I remember her telling me this story once from when she was a massage therapist, where a wealthy woman asked her how she was going to get a job with all of her face tattoos. And Bartle responded something like, I'm amazing at what I do. And once I lay my hands on someone and they feel it, their judgments fall away and they don't care what I look like. The client was in awe of her after that and recommended her to many others. Bartle has been living away from urban centers in Montana for the last few years, and I've been following through rumors and stories from our mutual friends and now through her Instagram account. I'm constantly amazed and envious of her lifestyle, which you'll get a glimpse of in this interview. We talk about her practice of running, going on minimalist wilderness living walkabouts, her annual meat processing camp, and a lot more. I remember you talking to me about your running practice like way back in the day, and that it was something that you did and that you did regularly. So when I started to see you talking about a little bit on Instagram, I was like, oh yeah, that's right. So I just wanted to ask you, like, when did you get into running and why and all of that stuff? What's the story behind that?
Yeah, so I started getting into running in my young adult life. I grew up studying dance pre-professionally in an urban environment, and movement was just a way to bring me into my body and to give me permission to feel things fully and to connect with nature and people and music and communicate in ways that I wasn't and have tools to do so in an urban environment growing up in Akron, Ohio. And at around age 14 or so, you get asked the question, are you going to be professional?
Like in dancing?
Yes.
Yeah, wow.
And my answer was yes, I wanted to be a professional dancer. And then, but then the really devastating, heartbreaking moment of them sitting me down and saying, you don't have the right body type. That was kind of like the beginning. And I always like add that into my story so that people know that like I didn't grow up running and I grew up moving my body and interacting in a close way with movement and dance. And then from there, I took many years, just like a break. I kind of, my whole body froze up and my heart froze up with it. Mm-hmm. And years and years later, I moved out west and didn't have a vehicle and started bicycling places. And then eventually I kind of started jogging. I could say I was kind of in the realm of a jogger for a few years. I would maybe run 1 to 3 miles a few days a week. And then out one point, I moved up into the Met Hal in Twist, Washington, and interned with a woman, Katie Russell, up there for 6 months. And that's really when I had the time and the space and the foothills to start running. So that's when I started building a deeper connection with running and even realizing and identifying as a runner. And really feeling the healing of that. And from there, I ended up going into Montana and kept running, and started doing my own survival trips, my own walkabouts, my own short solos. And I decided that I wanted to run 50 miles. I'd never done that. So I made this route in Montana in the lower foothills, and I was going to make it a 5-day trip. So I was just going to run 10 miles and then kind of like go walking or, you know, take my day bag off and explore. And I set off for that trip and I just ran and I didn't stop. And I was just blown away. I mean, my heart was just like bursting open and my like, I could feel every cell in my body just kind of like feeding me more and more energy. And I didn't even know that those quote unquote like ultra marathons existed. I didn't know. I just had these thrift store Nike sneakers and like had a miniature kids JanSport backpack on. And so, yeah, that was the first big run I did. And then,
so how long did it take you?
Yeah, I ran it in under 24 hours.
So wait, you ran 50 miles in less than 24 hours?
Yeah, and I slept for about 6 hours that night too.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And then I took like a week off and put together a longer run. I wanted to run the whole entire Gravelly Mountain Range.
That is awesome.
And that was a 75-mile run. And so then I spearheaded that run. And so that's kind of where running and my relationship with running has taken me, and it keeps transforming and shifting, and I'm always playing with running, walking, all sorts of different movement challenges.
Yeah, so I'm like seeing all these different possibilities. If you have the ability to run 50 miles in that short of amount of time, it's like, you know, when I think about being back in the wilderness or something like that, if something happened and you could run out that fast, you know what I mean? Like, I just took my wilderness first responder last fall. And I'm just thinking, like, when you're that far out and something bad happens, like, hopefully it wouldn't happen to you if you were running, if it debilitated you from running, right? But like, if something happened to a friend and you had to like get out of some place that you were deep in without cell phone or without any range like that, that's a really great skill to have, to be able to get back for rescue. I'm just thinking, you know, that's one application that popped into my head just thinking about it. Yeah, that's really cool. Do you run barefoot?
Yeah, I do a fair bit of barefoot running. I have a very serious frostbite injury on one of my feet. And so temperature is really important with running. And every spring, once the snow has melted and the ice has melted, I start barefoot running. And I actually like to start barefoot running on concrete. It just toughens up my feet pretty quickly. And it keeps me really hyper aware of stepping lightly, stepping gently, knowing that I'm like interacting with this material that has been planted here, you know, and it has, like, it can be so harsh on the body. So it really kind of forces me to waken up my senses and move with gentleness and grace. And then in combination with that, I do lots of barefoot walking. But once I get those nice calluses and my arches feel strong and all my little muscles in between my toes feel awake and alive, then I can start running on rocks and more dynamic terrain and more messed up as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's awesome. This is like a personal survey that I like to give to people in terms of barefootedness. Did you go barefoot a lot as a kid?
No.
Okay.
No, I wanted all the cool sneakers. Yeah. No, I didn't barefoot that much as a kid at all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I ask because, you know, I did a year of being barefoot when I was like 19.
Oh, wow.
And I still, even at the end of that year, couldn't really walk on gravel without like having to tiptoe. Like the pain, I think there's some sort of weird thing where like, even though I had thick calluses, like one time I stepped on something and I was like, what's that? And I looked and it was like a huge piece of glass that had gone into my heel because I had like a half an inch, you know, callus on my heel and the glass stabbed into it and I didn't even really feel it. Like there was no pain. I just pulled the glass out and kept walking. But still, for whatever reason, like that gravel feeling, I don't know, it just always felt like needles on the bottom of my feet, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That makes me think of my friends that hit barefooting really hard and don't go into it gradually. And it's almost as if they have the external calluses on their feet, but they also have a little bit of bruising right under their bones. And I've noticed that my friends also that practice hand drill way too much when people are like super excited about it. Mm-hmm. And they'll get that. They'll have these strong calluses, but then they're like, it always hurts. And it's like underneath the bone, you can just start bruising those most muscles. And
yeah, interesting.
It sounds a little bit like that. But what am I?
Yeah, well, I really want to try it again one of these days, but I'm just trying to like figure out if I can give myself an excuse like, well, I didn't do it as a kid, so I didn't get that brain connection, foot connection or something that I was like, well, I don't have to do it. But hearing you say that gives me hope that actually maybe I'll try that this spring or something.
That's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. So maybe describe like what a walkabout is. Because I know a lot of people don't really know. I don't know if a lot of people know the whole concept of that.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to only speak as to what a walkabout is for me.
Cool.
Because there's ways that many other cultures have reference to that term.
Totally.
And a relationship with walking on the land. Mm-hmm. So a walkabout specifically for me references more closer to a wander versus I have to go from here to here, or I have, you know, I do a lot of backpacking as well. Well, if I walk the Colorado Trail, I would kind of call that an adventure hike or a backpacking trip. A walkabout is when I kind of blend, I choose a landscape, I choose a rough route, and then I set some intentions. And those intentions could vary anywhere from something simple and a practical primitive skill that I just need to practice. So an intention could be, I'm going to set 5 figure 4 traps a night. And the amount that I walk doesn't matter that much. Necessarily where I'm walking doesn't matter that much, but that's my intention. Another intention could be, I did a trip 3 years ago where I went out into southern Utah in December, and my intention was I wanted to live in a primitive structure. I'd never done that. And so I went out there and I built a wiki-up and I lived in it for 80 days. And so from there, I would do day hikes, or sometimes I would kind of move camp for a few nights and then come back. But in general, a walkabout is a wander with some type of intention of something I'm wanting to work on. And it really gives me a good excuse to send more energy in those weak spots or those parts that I want to strengthen or spend more time doing. Because once I go back to my yurt, or I go back to food camps, or I go back to visiting friends, it's harder for me to prioritize these things that I want to dive deep in. Mm. So my walkabouts really help create discipline and intention.
Yeah, that's awesome. What's the longest time you've spent on a walkabout?
Without ever coming into town, 80 days.
Yeah. Is that the one where...
Or seeing anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 80 days straight without seeing anybody?
The 80-day trip was done with one other person. So I do a lot of my trips with people or friends or my partner. But yeah, I went 80 days without seeing anyone else.
Yeah.
Other than the person I was on the trip.
What are you eating during this time?
Yeah. For this trip specifically, or okay,
just in general, but you could, yes. I'm like 80 days. Did you bring food with you, or was there like hunting and gathering going on, that kind of stuff?
Cool. So it depends on, I don't know how to really categorize what the trips I do are, because they are very broad. I am not someone that just goes out with animals. I am not someone that just is an ultra runner. I'm not someone that just practices hunter-gatherer skills. I practice them all in varying degrees. And so for the longer base camp trip, the 80-day trip, I carried in as much food as I could, ran out of food around day 54, and then had a trap line of up to 40 traps, was eating well under 400 calories a day for at least 2/3 of it. And I was only foraging this weird little thing in the rhubarb. Yeah, it was like this weird rhubarb plant. It was super bitter and nasty. I was in Southern Utah in the middle of winter, so there wasn't a ton of roots or tapping. And so I ate a lot of mice. And at one point I was on a day hike, and I was walking in this tight slot canyon, and I popped out of the slot canyon, and it opened up into this meadow, and this bird of prey flew over me twice, cawed, and then dropped a jackrabbit right in front of me.
What? That's awesome.
So it's funny, but the biggest thing I ate there was a jackrabbit that I did not even catch. I did not catch a single jackrabbit.
Wow. Yeah. Do you think it was like, I got to give this starving person some food? Yeah. That's like a really cool gift.
Yeah. That was really amazing. Yeah. And on my backpacking trips, I'll make my own pemmican. I work at a butcher shop seasonally, and I render lots of fat and make a ton of jerky every year. I dry greens, I dig roots, I pick fruit. And so I'll supplement my backpacking food with as much wild food as I ended up gathering that year. But I also totally just stay on the safer, frugal side and eat lots of oats, rice, dried beans, jerky, just dried fruit, things that I can afford and process and make sure that I get enough calories. And my caloric intake, depending on the trip, can vary all the way from under 400 calories a day to up to almost 5,000 calories a day, depending on athletically what my challenge is. And I've also noticed that the trips where I'm eating way more, I lose way more weight, because I'm just cranking. They're my athletic challenges. and the challenges, the trips where I'm starving, it's interesting. It's almost like my metabolism can kind of sit on itself, like, which I feel very grateful for. So,
yeah.
So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's funny, for some reason in the last few months, I've just been really looking into caloric intake and trying to understand how all of that works and paying attention to it. I think in a large part, probably in terms of like watching The Alone Show, and they're always like talking about the people's calories and their intakes, stuff like that. And then talking to Onia about the same kinds of thing of caloric intake. It makes me wonder, have you thought about going on one of those shows? All of your skills and everything that you're doing is like exactly, I feel like there's not a lot of professions anymore that really utilize these skills, right? And that is one of those things that tends to attract people like yourself who are doing a lot of these skills, who are focused on this as a life way. And I'm just curious if you've ever thought about going on there, and if so, why not?
To really just kind of, long story short, I'm just not comfortable with TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have any judgments to my friends and even allies and even certain shows that I end up watching. I am so happy for everyone that is like receiving that resource and getting financial support for doing trips or just doing what they're doing. I think it's more just my uncomfortability with camera in general. Maybe down the line, I'll totally be ready for something like this. And that would be really cool. But yeah, I don't know. In general, it's just like not a part of my mission.
Totally.
Yeah.
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 What are the safety concerns when you're on a walkabout, particularly, like, obviously there's going to be different safety concerns for different environments, for the length that you're out there, the season you're out there. But a couple of things I think about is like being alone, you know, going on a solo, and then also going with a group of people. Like, what are your safety concerns? And have you ever had like a crisis type situation that has put you into a more of along the lines of a survival situation where you're like, okay, I actually have to evacuate now?
Oh, cool. Yes. So exactly like what you said, every landscape has, you know, a certain safety concern might be heightened in the desert differently than a safety concern heightened in, you know, the Oregon coast or, so it really changes from space to space and person to person and season to season, just like what you said. And I walk in so many different landscapes and terrain, and that is part of what I love keeps me learning. Because there's like the art form of like practicing non-attachment as I change from even morning into afternoon into evening in one given day. It's just so amazing what the land and the environment and the weather will bring out in my body and how to stay safe, healthy, and well. Always changes. And I was in a surprise survival situation 2 weeks ago. And this might be one of the first times that this has ever happened where it was a non-intentional survival trip. But I was up helping in the Gravelly Mountain Range. It's hunting season here in Montana. And I was helping a friend set up some wall tents and structures for this all-female hunting camp she was about to put on. And a really, really big blizzard rolled in. Before you know it, there's snow drifts that are taller than me. And we were packing up camp and decided to try to get out in her vehicle. She has a nice big Toyota Tundra, you know, and we kind of get stuck. We shovel out, we get stuck, we shovel out. We get stuck a third time in a really big snowdrift. And we check in. It is early in the day. And we decide to attempt walking. With my comfort level, I would feel safe walking out. Whereas I feel like as a baseline, if you have food, if you have water, if you have shelter, stay where you are. People will find you. but I wanted to give it a try. We started walking, the storm got worse, and my friend, I kept kind of encouraging her and saying, you know, if there's a shift in thought or kind of an intuitive hit or some type of explosive fear, any type of response that you feel as if you want to return to the vehicle, let me know. And so we might have walked maybe 2-3 miles, and she was pretty sure. She's like, I want to return. I was like, I think that's a really good call. That's smart. So we returned back to her vehicle, and we just sleep right in her vehicle and wrap wool blankets around us and get all of our frozen, wet cold icicle clothes off. so that was like 24 hours of being stranded for the storm to pass before we could walk, which was a really cool, exciting experience. And I'm really grateful that I wasn't alone for that.
So were you, like, was the car like covered in snow?
Completely. Yeah, it was. Yeah. There was snow up to, you know, to open the door, you're kind of just like pushing the where the snow was ending. So it was, the car, vehicle was completely stuck. And yeah.
Did you have snowshoes?
No, I didn't. Oh, wow. I just had some like thrift store rubber boots and some running shoes. It's just kind of how I roll.
Yeah. Did you, so the next day or 24 hours later, you walked out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. we walked out and we might have walked maybe around only like 6 miles or so. And then people caught wind that we were up there and were definitely worried about us. So there were people trying to drive up the mountain and we saw them and we got out.
Nice. Yeah. So is the car like still snowed in or is it, you know, like, wow.
She got it out a week later.
Okay. Yeah. Dang. Wow. Yeah. You know, here in like the Northwest, there's just not a lot of snow really. Like, well, in Portland, I should say, you know, like outside of Portland, we got like Mount Hood and stuff, but like, you know, we just don't, there's just not a lot of like, snow stuff.
Yes, totally. Yeah. Yeah, and so if it comes to the best, you know, or the most important survival advice in a cold environment, I would say get bundled up before you get cold. So here's an example. Mm. If you're sitting by a fire in the evening and you're just sitting, it's warm, it's turning to evening, dark time, and you get that kind of first shiver, and you're like kind of shaking. Bam, put on some layers, because the sooner you warm your body up before it gets cold, your circulation will stay increased and on the surface, and your pores will be nice and open and you can interact with that wool or that warm layers or the down that you're trying to keep warm with. And it's a lot easier to stay warm and it requires a lot less energy than if you're cold trying to make yourself warm.
So that's a bummer. Did the camp get canceled then?
No, the weather cleared up.
Awesome. Well, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah. And then all these ladies rolled in throughout the U.S. and they all went hunting together.
Oh, that's so cool.
I was just like, it was funny. They're like, how is setting up camp? And I was like, well, I'll just let Harmony tell this story. I'm going to go home and rest.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. So during this time of year, you run a hide camp?
Yeah. So this is a food camp. And me and my friends that put it together, we all call it Deer Season. It originally started out as a class and then was passed down to someone who started it as a class with me as well. So we would bring in students and drive to the butcher shop and show people how to skin deer. And then we'd bring back the hides and teach people how to brain tan. We would collect a lot of roadkill. Collecting roadkill in Montana is legal. And so we'd collect roadkill and teach people how to break the whole animal down and use it for various foods and tools and even like traditional games. And then, you know, it's just that thing where you're like, gosh, I would just rather it be a free food camp. And I want it to be an excuse for my friends to take some time to all gather together for longer than a week, you know? So it's a month long. And some years, 4 to 6 people show up. And one year we had over 20 people there. Yeah, it's just, there's so many butcher shops in this little area. There's so much meat in these shops going to waste. And as scavengers, we just go to create life out of the death that's being wasted. And try to honor the deer and the elk and the antelope and all the roadkill the best way that we can by repurposing it and reusing it and relearning from it. And then also it's on a property that whatever we don't use, it can go to a giant compost pile. And there we watch all the chickadees and magpies and coyotes come and just eat and process and enjoy all this death as well. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Do you draw, like, how do you process the meat? Are you drying stuff? Are you freezing stuff?
Yes.
Curing with salt?
Yeah. When it comes to the meat, I almost always dry as much as I possibly can for my backpacking trips. And sometimes I'll pulverize it and add it with rendered deer fat just to make pemmican. Sometimes I keep it as plain jerky. I usually pressure can the pieces that are a little too sinewy and have collagen on them and stuff that cannot be dried, and I just pressure can them. I've done some fermenting experiments that I would not call successes.
Fermenting with meat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then always, like, you know, I just value all the organ meat and and the bone broth. Even the bone broth, I will reduce down to a hard jello and dehydrate completely and powder. Mm. So I make my own bone broth that I take and put in all my dishes on the trail. There's lots to do.
That's
with
awesome.
Meat that I also haven't experimented with and stuff. But the camp is, I wouldn't call it primitive because there's just a little bit of electricity on this property. Yeah, so we do what we can just by wood stove and sunlight. Yeah.
I've always wanted to go to Montana for hide season.
Yes, you should come out. I'd love to have you come
one of these days.
Yes. Yeah,
what's the time frame anyway for that?
Yeah, so I would say it depends on if people want to come out during bow season. Antelope season is a little bit before rifle season. Or come for rifle season. So pretty much anywhere between like mid-September all the way into February, there is endless animals being processed. And the gathering that I hold is usually the month of November.
Mm, cool. Mm. In terms of like the gleaning, scavenging aspect, is it other hunters are bringing in stuff to a game processing and all they want is like the standard cuts and they're not interested in organ meats or like legs or things like that? Like, what is the process there in terms of reaching out to the butcher shops and asking them? There's a butcher shop in Portland that I go to sometimes and get deer legs, and it's like, you know, they're cutting off from the elbow all the way to the hoof, and there's meat in there, there's hide, there's sinew, there's bones, you know. So I get some of that stuff sometimes, but is that mostly the kind of thing that you're getting?
Well, it really depends. As a skinner, I was not getting very much meat and was mostly getting meat from locals that really want to kill things and don't want to use the animal, and they bring it to the property. So we have processed fresh kills and gotten whole animals.
Just because people... they're not interested in actually eating the meat. They're just killing them for sport.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. That's insane.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it is.
Hey, they're, you know, your gain, I guess. It's still getting used.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool.
It's like, it's a fine line because, you know, sometimes these people that bring in these animals that they just want to kill, they're like 16 years old. And so we all gently try to talk about the beauty in the animal and all the things we're going to use with it, or ask them if they want to stay to watch us skin it. And sometimes you can catch interest and sometimes not, but to create that change verbally and or from example, I've stopped trying to tell myself that I'm not making a difference and have just started doing me and being me and trying to share. And just trust that there might be seeds that are planted in people that totally. Might turn into sprouts, you know?
Yeah.
And so with these people that bring these animals, I'm just like, well, I'm just going to keep trying in a gentle way. And who knows how it's affecting them or not, you know? So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And at the butcher shops, there's, on average, they waste 40% of the animal.
Wow.
So I don't know if, you know, if you've ever seen an elk rib cage, but they are these beautiful, huge parts of the body. And you can cut maybe sometimes even 2-inch wide strips that run almost 2 feet long and are about 1 inch thick, completely wasted. Honestly, because the elk ribs, that meat in there is kind of like meat, fat, meat, fat, meat, fat, these layers. It's just like perfect bacon. So there's so much of the animal that these shops do not use that we just take big piles of, endless piles to River Camp and see what meat is good, what's usable, what's not, what fat we can render, and all kind of get to work in our very varying degrees of where our interests lie.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So is it just like, I mean, I'm imagining like there's like meat drying over here. There's like bone broth going over there. It's like, you know, all the different like there's somebody scraping a hide over there. Like all the different things kind of happening.
Yes, at an enormous degree, because there might be over 1,000 deer skins being processed and salted that all of my friends just take.
1,000.
Or, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
There are, I remember one point, one friend in one weekend of working got 70 antelope hides. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so it is a food camp that has endless resources, and all we desire is for people to come with interest in participating in using up these materials and tools in whatever degree they want.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
Yeah.
Do you end up selling hides or bones or any of those things? Like,
some people that come to this food camp make a living doing that.
Yeah.
And I do commission buckskin clothing. And other than that, I'm not selling brain tan or salted hides right now. Yeah. I just realized something. When you asked me the longest time I've been without seeing someone, I just remembered that at day 54, a friend came to visit.
That's so, totally fine. Yeah.
So anyway, I'm just going to say that the longest I've been on a trip without running into anyone other than who I was on the trip with was 54 days.
Yeah, cool. And what's the longest you've been just solo?
I have not done an extensive solo. I have done walks on more common footpaths like the Appalachian Trail and meet people on the trail. So the longest I've been on a trip without seeing anyone, 6 days.
Yeah, cool. In terms of being out on a walkabout, there's like a headspace I feel like I get into sometimes when I'm doing those types of things. It feels like when you go back to doing something like that, like you never left, like you're still there or something. Do you feel different in your day-to-day life than when you are on your walkabouts? And how, like, what is the difference?
That's a great question. I feel very different when I'm out doing trips of varying degrees versus my day to day. When I first head out on a walk, I kind of call it the detox phase, where sometimes it takes only 3 days or so. Sometimes it takes me a whole week. And it's kind of like every day as I'm walking, I just feel an aspect of shedding and or melting that's kind of happening. And my breath gets fuller, or you know, my shoulders might feel a little bit more relaxed, or anxiety, my thoughts slowly start to slow down. And even the way that I converse happens a lot slower too, along with becoming a much better listener. So those are kind of the broad aspects of shifts that start happening in the detox phase. And then once I am really in it, the best way I can describe it is I'm just there. I am happy. I am curious about every moment. I am willing and open to be the person that I need to be in that moment. And I also always notice that when I'm out, I give myself a lot more permission to make mistakes or to ask questions to myself or the land, or to just be. Mm-hmm. And I also notice that after a longer trip, man, I will come back and I could set all the intention in the world that I'm like, I'm gonna feel this feeling and I'm gonna bring it back with me. Or I wanna be able to tap into this feeling when I need it most. Or I really wanna just, you know, be this Bartle in my other everyday life. And I will pray, or I'll set intention, or I'll journal, or I'll even do a practice that will try to remind me of it. And it like bleeds out into it. It comes with me, but within a week or two, I just feel that strength and that self-love and that power and that gratitude. And it just crumbles. It mm-hmm. totally does. And I just kind of have to like wave goodbye and be like, I'll see you soon. Mm. And yeah, so I feel huge transitions and they're really hard to go through and there's very little support for them. But yeah. Yeah.
During the detox phase, when you're out there, do you feel like, this is kind of like a two-sided question. It's like when you go out there, do you feel like, why am I doing this? I should be like doing the work things, or is there like, you know, are there like addictions to civilization that try to pull you back in from a walkabout? Or like when you've set your mind to it and you're out there, you're like used to it at this point. You're just like, I have nothing drawing me back or trying to like, you know, you can't leave, you know, like that kind of thing, right? Are there things that try to pull you back and keep you from detoxing and fully embracing that type of mindset that you have on the walkabout? And then the second part of the question is, when you come back to civilization, is it the same kind of thing where you're like, the walkabout thing is like, don't go, or is it, you know, you're finally coming back into this other thing that you feel like excited. Like, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes. One thing that's very interesting about the adventures I do is that even when they're hard, I know that they are temporary and they have an end point. And that end point is usually up to me unless an emergency happens. And so heading out on a trip is not challenging. It's usually just incredibly exciting, especially because there's a certain amount of preparation and groundwork that you need to put into trips, planning food, figuring out where you're going to walk, mapping out a route, all those things. And so when your dream becomes reality, it is just so filled with opportunity and potential. And so heading out is almost never a challenge. And being out is not a challenge. And the challenges that come up are these like juicy moments that are an opportunity for me to like create anew within myself and within around. And so going out and being out is not a challenge. And again, like what I said, there's this like cushion of it's temporary. So it's not like a apocalyptic moment, you know, this is just my reality now. I just have to run 40 miles a day. You
know? Yeah.
And when I am back in my community and back trying to find forms of income or to support myself or putting together classes to teach or crafting for selling things and stuff, it's more like there's too much for me to do. And I notice that I will want that stuff to go away, but it doesn't, because that's the stress of our culture, this many responsibilities. So I definitely dream about going on my next trip often, and definitely feel my trips pulling me back out.
Cool. The guy that I interviewed, who's a psychologist, Leonard Martin, his whole thing is like, one of his obsessions, I should say, is that the search for meaning is something that has occurred only in people who have cultures where long-term planning is like embedded in it. So, you know, in an immediate return society where you're just eating hand to mouth with the wild, nobody's ever like looking for meaning. And he has this example where if somebody's doing something they really love and they're right in the middle of it, like for you, it's maybe running, you know, that you stop them in the middle of it and you're like, does your life have meaning? And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm like doing this thing right now. I'm like in the moment. But then you find that same person like at their office job or something, you know, and they're like, does your life have meaning? And they're like, no, I hate my life. You know, so it's interesting hearing you, like, it's interesting thinking about this, his sort of that idea in the context of these walkabouts where it is very much like in the moment. And I think the same thing with like a alone show or something like that, where you're like, your day to day of being in a walkabout is being in the moment and experiencing it. And I really appreciate what you're saying earlier about like different walkabouts have different intentions, where you're like focusing on different skills or different ideas and things like that. Even though that's like, in a sense, kind of planning, it's not really, it's just like you're following your inspiration in that regard. So there's no like boundaries or something, and it makes it sound very appealing.
Someone put it really well, and I was talking with them and they voiced something along the lines of, when you're on a survival trip, you have just enough time in the day to do everything you have to do. You know, it could be collecting some firewood, repairing your shelter, going and checking your trap line. And then at first he said, and no time to do anything else, because you like actually take your time to do it. And then he's like, wait, no, I mean, you don't have any desire to do anything else.
Yeah.
And you actually really see how simple and satisfying the spaciousness of those chores and the transitions in between them, how necessary they are. Whereas in our culture, we flip-flop from so many different roles and rules and things to do that there isn't really transition periods. And I noticed that when I come back from trips, I'm like, my mind does not want to move this quick. And so now I'm blaming myself and feeling stunted, when really I should just remind myself that I'm like, well, we're probably a lot simpler than we're trying to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yet we're still just as deep. If that makes
right.
sense.
Totally. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to chat about or that you feel excited about?
I am planning my biggest walk yet, starting in the spring. I'm not going to say exactly where it's starting and ending yet, but I have a goal to walk 3,000 miles. And it is not on any of the common three trails. Long trails that are out there, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So how long of a trip would that take?
I would guess that it will take roughly 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm you know, I'm kind of shooting for just making it 1,000 miles and then checking in with myself and going from there. Because I don't want to walk if that's not where my heart is at. And I've noticed that trips tell me when they're over instead of me deciding when they're over often.
Totally.
And I think that that's a really healthy way to end them.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what happens, but yeah, I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, that's cool. I guess there's two things that I think about in terms of like going on a walkabout. One is in terms of like getting the things done that you need to get done and then just like hanging out. Part of me feels like I haven't really done a long walkabout before. You know, I did Lynx's program. The majority of that was camped. And then we did a week. I was only on a week of the project before I left. There's this feeling of me that I feel like I would get bored. And I don't know if that's just like my own mind or something, but I have two questions. One is like, do you get bored and what do you do when you get bored? Or is it a thing where like maybe boredom is part of that detox phase that you were talking about? And once you kind of break through that, maybe your brain is just like in a different wavelength or, you know, literally like different electrical whatever, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Boredom is never anything I've struggled with out there. But what I do feel is deep relaxation. And I am such a minimalist. And so a lot of the tools and things that I do that bring me joy, I carry with me. So I'm a dancer and I'm a singer and I'm a beatboxer. And I also really like to draw in sand or make sculptures with stones. I really like to go swimming and play in water. And so even when I'm not quote unquote hunting, gathering, tending, doing other chores in camp, oh my gosh, I'm like, finally, I have time to actually create song, which in my other world outside of trips, I have to schedule that in. You know, I have to be like, I'm going to have a morning song practice. Whereas when I'm out, there's space for that. And so for me, yeah, I don't struggle with boredom. And I also think that has evolved. I've been doing this for over 10 years now. So I used to have my joys involve more tools or instruments or interactions with people. And so I had to train myself out of that and relearn skills that and crafts and the joys that I can carry everywhere with me, because I would still categorize myself in like the busybody realm. And so that is how I have kept boredom far away. It's just find things that I can take out with me that still bring tons of stimulus in like my being that I like to work with and stuff. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, that makes me think of another question, which is in terms of the walkabouts and running, what kind of training do you do for that, like physically?
Oh man, this is funny. I'm going to sound like such a jock.
That's okay.
which to a certain extent, I really am. And and I'm given a lot of crap from my friends that, you know, are into like natural movement or ancestral skills because they're like, working out is so stupid. I just chop firewood, you know? Whereas I train a lot. And a lot of my day is based around aspects of movement and training. And what is equally as important in that is how much I rest and how much I let my body recover and repair. My training involves lots of running, lots of body weight movement stuff. I definitely lift weights and do all sorts of climbing and hanging experiments. I'm also a very beginner boulderer and rock climber. I love to climb trees and I stretch and I do yoga and I dance. So it just, it keeps going. I could, the list goes on a lot, but yeah, I like breathing exercises. I like trying to hold my breath underwater, just lots of varying degrees of strength training. And the one thing that I don't do a lot of is stretching, because I grew up as a dancer and I'm overly flexible. I don't think you have to be much more flexible than being able to sit on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, a lot of people would probably disagree with me, but I got a lot more injuries when I was a lot really flexible. And as a runner, I feel like strength is pretty important. So I could say one thing I do the least of is stretching.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I keep hearing that more and more from everybody I know who does training and stuff, is that stretching is sort of taking a back seat.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Cool. Yeah. There's a lot of theory that it leads to more injury, specifically just like what you said.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm like kind of jumping down into that world myself in terms of training and thinking about all that, getting older and working, you know, running a nonprofit. It's like I'm sitting behind a computer screen and, you know, it's hard for me to get out and do stuff. So I'm in a sense a jock as well.
Yeah.
Just being able to kind of like play around with my body in that way as I'm getting older and trying not to like fossilize, you know. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why I'm interested in chatting with you specifically about running and walking is like, you know, I read Katie Bowman's book, Move Your DNA. And it's just basically about like the less you move throughout your life, the stiffer and stiffer and less agile and mobile you'll be as you get older. So it's kind of like you have to keep doing all of those things. So it's really inspiring to hear about your running practice, but also the walkabout practice and how it relates to rewilding. And
yeah, I also want to make sure that I express that I am definitely an extreme example of experiments and things to do with the body and trips as well. And I just definitely want to make sure that people know that like the act of walking is very good for the body, similarly to the act of just being able to sit on the floor, your hips, your back, your spine. There's a certain level of flexibility required to just simply sit on the ground. And that no one needs to train or move their body as much as I do. And I had dinner with a friend a couple nights ago, and he does a lot of office work as well. As field work for his job. And he was like, oh, I was sitting at the computer for like 3 hours and like I could just feel my lower back hurt and my hips starting to get sore and my knees felt like they were swelling up just sitting. And then he's like, I went on a 10-minute walk and I was just pain free.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just think that, you know, the act of walking can do so much. And the easiest way to access walking for me, if I'm busy or don't have time to train, I walk in between chores. So if I have a morning chore and I have space to walk, even just for 10 or 20 minutes, I'll walk. And then I'll do my other chore. And it also just clears my mind too, you know. But yeah,
totally.
I've never undermined the act and the art of the simple ways that our bodies and people throughout time have used them for sure.
Hmm. I think sort of the last question is, what tips do you have for somebody who is inspired, you know, might be inspired by hearing about your story and wanting to do a walkabout? What would be a starting point for somebody thinking about this?
Yeah. Okay. If you want to learn how to walk, which is quite different than base camping. A lot of schools do lots of base camping. Walking, it's like moving camp every single day. Maybe walking 5 to 10 miles a day. It requires like a varying degree of other skills. Navigation is very important in learning to walk, and also just strengthening your body and your mind in that way to move. Honestly, I would recommend taking a class from Boulder Outdoor Survival School, because they're one of the only walking schools, like that I know out there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never taken one of their like basic courses, but I have a lot of friends that have, and all the other schools that I know about do not walk unless I don't know, you come hang out with me.
Yeah.
Some other people I know, but yeah, I got to take a desert navigation field course there, and I just loved it. And they also, on their courses, often have a solo. So you get to walk solo or base camp solo, which is another pretty important aspect of being able to be out, is to be able to be alone.
Are you mostly self-taught?
I have had mentors. And my main mentor I have to thank is Chris Reed. He has been a part of helping Thomas Elpel run his adult program for the past 12 years. And he started out doing walks with Tom Elpel and survival trips. And I was fortunate to meet Chris through Katie Russell 6 years ago. And we do a lot of trips together. And that person moves on the land more thoroughly, intentionally, and gracefully, and organized more than anyone I've ever seen all the people that I've done trips with. I just really appreciate that person's aspect of awareness, minimalism, and attention.
Mm. Well, that's all I got.
Awesome.
That was awesome.
Yay.
Yeah, thank you so much. There's an English slang word, coddywomple. It means to travel in a purposeful manner toward a vague destination. I often think about this word in my rewilding practice because I feel it sums up the process. We don't want to move toward a predefined idea of what wildness is, but purposefully allow our wildness to take shape as part of the process itself. My current definition of rewilding aligns with this word coddywomple. Rewilding means, to me, to purposefully travel toward wildness, but without preconceived notions of what that wildness will look like. I'm bringing this up because of Bartle's definition of a walkabout, which was a wander with some kind of intention. I really enjoyed these parallels and continue to think about all the ways in which we can go on little and large walkabouts in our coddywomple of rewilding. I hope you take away some inspiration from Bartle and her story, as I have. You can follow her on Instagram at Bartle Emily, BartleEmily. Check out the podcast notes for a couple links to things that we referenced in our conversation. And of course, if you like this podcast and you want to see it continue, please become a recurring supporter, share with your friends on social media, follow me on social media, and write us a review on iTunes. Thank you.